This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Wednesday, February 15th, 2017. I'm Caleb Brown. The exit of Mike Flynn as National Security Advisor reveals more than just the details of an ill-advised conversation with a Russian official. It reveals the degree to which intelligence agencies can use their troves of data to move politics and policymakers without clear oversight. Cato Senior Fellow Julian Sanchez comments. We now know that Mike Flynn spoke with Russian ambassador before the inauguration of Donald Trump, which raises some issues with respect to changing administrations, and sort of the timing of that call was problematic. But we also know that there was this – how that information came to light with respect to the reporting on it is also on its, by itself problematic.
Yeah. I mean, to the extent we have an ongoing conflict between the new administration and the intelligence community, I find myself thinking of the tagline for the action film Alien v. Predator, whoever wins, we lose. We have on the one hand an administration that has been dismissive certainly all along of the growing and very strong intelligence community consensus that Russia had interfered on their behalf, publishing hacked, stolen emails from the DNC and from Clinton advisors in order to harm her chances and assist Trump, and who, you know, frankly, seems not particularly interested in pursuing that, and who, indeed, as we now know, thanks to further leaks, whose aides were in frequent contact with Russian officials throughout the campaign. When you combine that with the context of Trump's sort of surprising deference to and admiration for Russian autocrats, their intervention to change the GOP platform to treat Russia more gently with respect to their intervention in Ukraine. You know, it's certainly not unreasonable to wonder whether something suspicious and untoward is going on there. I mean, frankly, because the conduct during the campaign was so bizarre. And on the one hand, you do have to perhaps share the worry that it seems many in the intelligence community have that once Trump appointees are installed in law enforcement and intelligence agencies, the will to continue an investigation into any potential impropriety there will evaporate.
But it also speaks to just the power of these agencies themselves to, without any kind of apparent oversight, reveal damaging information about someone.
Absolutely, and that's the other half of this is why we're in such an uncomfortable position. Because you might well understand why the intelligence community would feel itself to be in an untenable position when, in a sense, the threat is coming from inside the house. When, in their perception, the national security threat is now in the White House and their nominal boss. On the other hand, yeah, if we look sort of historically, when the intelligence community slips the leash, right? When they, because they have such enormous troves of secret and potentially embarrassing or destructive information that gives them effectively the ability to decide who will have their political career torpedoed through selective leaking, that has not ended well. I mean, J. Edgar Hoover was feared and accumulated feudal power as director of the FBI over decades, in substantial part because his nominal overseers, both in Congress and even the executive branch, were effectively afraid of him. They didn't know what he might have on them, except in the rare cases where they found out to their cost. And so the idea that we now have a situation, whatever the extenuating circumstances might be, where political appointees are being torpedoed by, again, selective leaks of the contents of foreign intelligence intercepts, not that information being passed on to Congress, but showing up on the front page of the New York Times because
with names attached.
With names attached, and that's, you know, there was a piece in the Wall Street Journal saying, oh, it was so strange that Flynn's name wasn't minimized in these transcripts. As an internal matter, that's not really weird, right? Minimization means you take out the names of Americans when they're not relevant to understanding the foreign intelligence information that you've gathered.
Incidentally collected.
Right. Now, in this case, of course, the collection of Flynn is incidental in the sense that the targets here were Russian government officials, which is a legitimate target, and they happened to, in the course of targeting those people, pick up Flynn's voice. And if there was no foreign intelligence value or no foreign intelligence relevance to the fact that it was Flynn talking to them, then yeah, his name would have been minimized. But of course, why that conversation is relevant from a foreign intelligence perspective turns critically on the fact that it was the president's national security advisor having the conversation. So it's not surprising that his name was left in. The question is, look, should the way this process works be that the intelligence community does a lot of wiretapping, picks up an enormous number of communications between foreign officials and people in the United States, and then decides that one particular person's communication is sufficiently important for the public to know that it ends up on the front page of the New York Times. Now, I think there are a lot of reasons to want Flynn gone, to be wary of someone with his views and instincts in the role of national security advisor. I mean, among others, his attitude apparently that Islam per se, not jihadist ideology, but Islam the religion is effectively the adversary, something that's rational to fear. At the same time, you know, this is someone who had left the Obama administration under uncomfortable circumstances, who lots of folks at the CIA and the Pentagon sort of feared in a position of power, feared might hold grudges. So, you know, is there an argument that there is a sort of a public interest in disclosure of this? I think absolutely. But it's also very easy to convince yourself that the things that are in your personal interest or that match your personal desires are the things that are in the public interest. So almost independent of whether we think this is an extreme enough case or an extenuating circumstances case where going outside normal channels and letting the contents of these intercepts make their way to the press, you do have to be worried about the precedent this sets, about the idea that we're now again really watching the intelligence community decide, you know, clearly illegally, which intelligence intercepts are going to be leaked to press for, I think, what are pretty clearly political reasons. So there's in a sense no side you can take without some discomfort, I think, in this conflict.
What kind of parallels, if any, can you draw between this and the case of Ed Snowden, who we now know, made some efforts to follow the proper channels to deal with things that he found to be extremely bothersome and extremely troubling. And this case where perhaps Congress in its current configuration wouldn't find this information worth pursuing.
Right. I think there is something to that analogy, although I would be wary of stretching it too far. I mean, one important difference is that a classic whistleblower is someone who is within an agency or a government institution, or I suppose a corporate institution, who has derogatory information about the conduct of their own institution, and so feels that it's necessary to go outside to expose that internal wrongdoing. In this case, we're talking about people within the intelligence agencies exposing wrongdoing of their own institution, but rather deciding particular political appointees have misconduct that that needs to be exposed. And I think it's worth emphasizing that to the extent you have, again, both a campaign and now an administration with officials with pretty suspicious regular contacts with Russia, whose whole attitude and posture towards Russia is, again, frankly bizarre. And these are now the people running the government. There is a kind of macro whistleblowery sense in which you might reasonably worry. And I think what's going on here was the intelligence community is perhaps reasonably worried, at least in terms of the most recent disclosures involving campaign contacts with Russia over the course of the last year, that a incomplete investigation is going to be squashed by political appointees in order to conceal potential wrongdoing. That's a reasonable concern. And so from that perspective, there's a whistleblower aspect to it. It's an effort to effectively publish enough to immunize the investigation from political interference before it can run its course. On the other hand, you know, lots of political officials, political appointees, politicians themselves have, if you want to dig through their phone conversations and their emails, something that if you selectively revealed it would either be a crime, well, lots of things are at least arguably crimes, or look extremely bad politically. And so, again, whether or not we agree in this case, it has to make you uncomfortable that those judgment calls are being made by the folks within the agencies themselves. They're the ones deciding this can go through the normal process and we'll see if there's something that's worth bringing down an indictment and we'll forward this information to the appropriate agencies for prosecution. But no, in this case, actually, that's unlikely to succeed. And so the way we deal with it is by leaking effectively the contents of intercepts. Again, you might in the instance think that that's justified, but boy, howdy, does it have to make you swallow a little hard to think that this is something that's now a daily practice.
Julian Sanchez is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to and rate this podcast at iTunes and Google Play, and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.